But it was all that I could do to keep from crying.
Well, you know who had his ashes spread at home plate?
The dude that did the Go Cubs Go song.
Yeah,
wasn't his name Goodman?
Steve Goodman? Yeah, Steve Goodman.
You know what else he wrote?
He wrote the perfect country and western song, and then he sent it to either Waylon Jennings or one of those guys.
Well, a friend of mine named Steve Goodman wrote that song, and he told me it was the perfect country and western song.
They read it, and they said, this is almost perfect, but you didn't mention anything about mama or prison.
Because he hadn't said anything at all about mama.
Or train.
Or train.
Or pickup trucks.
Or trucks.
So then Goodwin allegedly wrote the next verse, which was, it was raining the day my mama got out of prison.
I was drunk the day my mom got out of prison. And I went to pick her up in the rain. But before I could get to the station in the pickup truck, she got run over by a damned old train. And I'll hang around as long as you will let me. And I never mind it standing in the rain. Oh, you don't have to call me
selling.
You're drowning and I throw you a life jacket. Would you grab it? Yes. Good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? I don't want to see those returns?
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show him a 3% return and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know that.
That's it. I'm done.
Jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here.
We're live.
Lord, my bag stocks and jocks. I'm Tom Howe. Jim Lawler on the board. S&P futures were down like 40 this morning, so we're kind of all over the place. We were obviously we had a huge week last week. We're actually down 43. NASDAQ futures down 205. So there, we got that going for us. We have Bitcoin down a bunch too, which is even more bizarre, but down like $3,000, so it's causing a little bit of a problem, I think. We also have Mr. John Lee with us. I believe we have Mr. John Flanagan in a bit, and we should have Audrey Johnson in a little bit as well. So we have a big show today, as usual. It'll be like Ed Sullivan. What is it, a big show? A big show, right?
I can remember watching him, and I actually remember when the Beatles first came on the show, and we were just, you know, beside ourselves. It was the first time they came on. We still lived in Virginia. I had to be, what, 8, 10 years old.
It was 1962?
The second time they came on, because I would have only been about 6 years old then.
Yeah, but, it was like 62 or 63. Yeah. Was on the black and white TV with the 2-inch speaker.
Oh yeah. With the antennas.
Oh yeah. We always said, "Now move the antenna over here, and move it over there." It was interesting times, as they say. Hey, John, they came out with John is kind of our resident. Ian Russell are kind of our resident experts on the China situation. When they talk about the news over the weekend, we'll start there. But obviously, we have an awful lot of stuff to talk about this morning, from you know, you name it, on down killings and whatever. Always good to talk about killings, eh? But the when they come out and they, the Chinese come out with official numbers. Now it was the imports this week. It was the GDP. Who are the? No, they always say it's a private firm that gives an estimate. Who is capable of giving an estimate on China's economy? I mean, what firm can even do that? I mean, here, like if you have the payroll people, you know, do an estimate on payrolls, well, hell, they write the checks for 45% of the country, so they have a pretty freaking good idea. I mean, in China, when these outside firms say, well, you know, we're gonna give an estimate on Chinese GDP or Chinese exports, where in God's name do they get the data? Do you have any idea?
Well, that's a big issue. It's been a big issue for 5 years, maybe even longer, because the Chinese government has, and they, you know, they've gone after a couple of these firms that have done this, and they've arrested their executives, or excuse me, detained them, especially the companies that are doing due diligence for acquisitions. They have an issue where if the numbers are too far from reality, everyone will know. You know, when Trump says it's, you know, we have no inflation, people go, well, I don't think so. So they can't make it too far. But yeah, I would always put a 30% swing on numbers out of China. That they have been modified 30% to make things look better than they are. You know, my friends that live there now, that still live there now, they say it is, you know, it's okay with a small zero, you know, with a small O. Well, it's barely okay, actually, is what they say.
Oh, they're living where? They're in Hong Kong or where the other cities?
Was that? Where have I been?
You know, where are your friends? What cities are they in?
Oh, they're all in the Shanghai, Beijing. And, I you know, my universe in China is Hong Kong, Chongqing, Chengdu, Beijing, and Shanghai. So the Chengdu and Chongqing are in the center of the country. And obviously, Shanghai and Hong Kong are on the coast. First of all, because the government considers these facts to be really national secrets, and they think they can be used against China, I would put any estimate, you know, with a grain of salt there.
So where the government stuff you don't believe either. So where does that leave you?
Well, you're guessing. Let me restate what I said. The private firms, if they're international firms, I put more credence into those numbers. The government, I was talking about the government numbers, not the private firms that are in there. But the private firms, remember, it's like, okay, if you want to stay, in the country and report on our economic data, you need to make sure you do the following things. So they've been compromised too. You know, unless you live in outside of China, you can't have an independent view.
Well, even if you do, they try and track you down, right?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
You know what they do is, and if you live in a foreign country, depends on the. If you live in Southeast Asia, you're in trouble. If you live in Vietnam, especially Thailand, or Cambodia, Vietnam a little less so, and actually Vietnam a lot less so, or Singapore, you're fine. But Thailand and Cambodia, they just come down and pick you up and take you out.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, you know, they've done it many times.
What? How much? I think if you were really clever, you could do stuff like. Remember back in the day when people, I don't know, this Business Week, they even come out. I mean, they must come out online, I think. But it used to be the Business Week number. You'd look on the inside of the front page. We give you all your economic numbers, and one of the ones that people always looked at was rail car loadings, right? And I think some people still look at that, but in China, even if you don't get any number from those idiots, you're going to be able to buy bills of lading, and people kind of, you know, some people know every ship that's on the sea, you can pretty much track, right? So
yeah.
So I mean, if all of a sudden you're you decide that the ships coming out of China and landing in Long Beach and 10 other ports are down 5% on the month, I think you can probably make some sort of a stab that the GDP in China is down, right? If all of a sudden their exports are down. I mean, you can make some sort of a stab, can't you?
Oh, yeah, and that's what they do. I mean, the Chinese exports, I mean, first of all, the domestic consumption is not that, you know, they've never been able to kickstart that because unlike us, they're savers. But the exports have held up surprisingly well. And also, I mean, we know Trump did cave, or if he hasn't, then he is going to.
Well, it's a deal. It's a deal. It's always going to be a deal, you know, so.
So Tom, go back. You know, the biggest thing is the seagoing the seagoing trade. That's really, you're right. That is what really will determine. You know, that gives you a good idea at least how the exports are doing, which takes care of it, which takes care of that section of the economy. But it you know, it's very difficult. And you know, they, until they really start to open up as far as figures go, I'll say with Russia, you are really stabbing, you know.
They're never going to open up. So, I mean, that's, you're always going to be stuck at the same spot. I mean, but, you know, people know I was never a fan of Trump from the day that, long before he was president, but that's another story. But I wouldn't wish this job kind of on anybody. I mean, you've got a group of people, I mean, clearly the Chinese are one of them, that are essentially adversaries, but they're also huge customers. I mean, and people buy stuff from here that they buy cheap stuff from there because people don't have any money. I mean, it's a very difficult, God, when I first got on the show, it had to be 15 years ago. I think my first, if you listen to the first show, I said, boy, this is pretty tough. And when you have you know, Bill Gates coming into the Oval Office, whoever was even president at the time, saying, hey, these bleeps, you know, bought two copies of software, and they own like 100 million machines, and my software is on it. I got a problem.
And he was one of the few that would have the backbone to do that, too.
Well, but
nobody else did it.
All of a sudden, a guy named Jimmy Lawler comes running in, and he's the president of Pepsi, and he goes, wait a minute. There's a billion people over there drinking a Pepsi a day. What are you doing?
I mean, or Boeing
or somebody. I mean, you end up with this, whether they're a customer or whether they're stealing is a whole different program. And I told a story, the poor guy's been dead forever, but my right after the ping pong diplomacy, one of the first companies into China was some outfit out of Columbus. I don't know if they were based in Columbus, but my mother's cousin, like I said, a guy's been dead for 15-20 years, he went to China. And they were a mining company with all this machinery and all this stuff. I don't think it was Bucyrus, but it was somebody like that. And the Chinese look at all their stuff and they go, we'll buy one of everything you have. And my cousin, this very tough Italian guy, goes, that's not happening. We're going back on the plane. See you, idiots. Because he knew exactly what was going to happen. They were going to take the thing apart and try and build it themselves. So
Or if they did manufacture there, they would have had to have a joint venture.
Yeah.
As, you know, and the stories are rife. I mean, I know people this has happened to. The stories are rife of, you know, they build a small manufacturing plant in China. And in 1 year, across the street is the exact same manufacturing plant built by their joint venture partner.
Yeah. It's but it was pretty obvious from the get-go, kind of that's where they were heading. I went to I don't know, for those that don't know, for a little while.
We tricked ourselves into believing that nobody could be as innovative as we are. That's the first thing. And we did not look at, you know, so we tricked ourselves into going, I remember during the Clinton era, everybody was making money in China. Yeah. We were exporting a ton. And we tricked ourselves into believing that they would, you know, nothing could ever happen. They would never move up the value chain. And also, they certainly seduced our Secretary of Treasury and Commerce back in the day, probably in multiple administrations. But, you know, they were always, you know, whether they were, I don't believe the fact that the Chinese are so good at foreign policy that they look, you know, 50 years
it's
in the future.
About, it's all about the money.
All this, it's all about the money. And you know, when you have, you know, when you have 800 million people that you're trying to bring up, or probably 1 billion people you're trying to bring up in the lower middle class, you know, those are some pretty hardworking folks.
Well, you're trying to, you're moving people from a family farm of, you know, maybe a half an acre into a city. And I guess now they've been with some kind of a job. But the, you know, the trick is, I mean, how much can you, I mean, the old adage is, you know, the capitalists will be happy to sell you the rope which you're going to hang them with. I mean, can you imagine if Hitler would have waited another 2 years before he invaded someplace? How many people have been dying to do business with the guy? Lindbergh was.
And they were. Well, we all know the case of Ford, but IBM was there until the end.
Well, IBM allegedly now, Kevin sent a missive out a couple of weeks ago that virtually all the software and all the hardware that China uses to spy on people there, and I'm guessing maybe here, are provided to them from IBM.
Cisco. I don't think, I mean, IBM was certainly in there. But Cisco was the main, because they
according to this article, IBM has been the last few years, IBM has been the lion's share of it. But I mean, there's other people involved. You know that. I mean, those that don't know, John was in the where they'd go out for bids on these real big things. Like if you're gonna redo your aircraft or airport tower in Turkey, John's firm would bid on it. Now, so when you go on those kind of bids, they pretty much say what everybody's stuff they want, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's basically, the only reason, you know, I did a consulting job with Nokia back in the day, and this is with their network equipment, not the phones, because their phones they had sold that. But, you know, the only reason Nokia got business there was through diplomatic pressure. So Nokia would get a contract because Finland then would buy some, you know, some Huawei equipment or something. It was pretty funny. But no, I mean, it was, you know, going back to whether all the stuff came from IBM, I'm sure a lot of it did. However, the real lion's share, the stuff they borrowed or, you know, they were sold was from Cisco, you know, the tap into the networking equipment. And then, of course, it spread out like a spider's web.
So, I mean, you're not going to stop people from doing that, and that you can't really. I mean, I wouldn't drop a cent. I don't know why. I mean, this is probably a one man's bad opinion. This guy who's head of NVIDIA, I wouldn't drop a tenth of a moral on that guy. I mean, he's this generation's Harold Janine. If I can make money on it, I don't worry about no governments. There's no stinking governments. I mean, that's what I.
He's bigger. Yeah, he's bigger. Know what? Think about it this way. He's bigger than every government except for two. Yeah. In the U.S., he can buy off. In China, he can buy off. I mean, he's some very... I think he's the most powerful businessman we've ever seen. And please correct me, Jimmy.
Well, Tom,
the president is the biggest, most powerful businessman. That's what he is.
Okay, that is very well said. Yes.
Well, yeah, that's an issue we haven't had to deal with before. I don't think, but anyway.
I'll send you guys an article from a foreign policy analyst about, you know, how this has been in the news already, how interlocked business deals are with this latest Ukrainian peace effort.
Oh, I can only imagine.
It is unbelievable.
Well, there was a whole
it
part
is all
the
business deals.
Didn't that's been Trump's deal. I mean, and people... Some people say it's a transactional thing. We need to let this go for a while. No, we don't. I mean, it's not. Anyway, what started this whole conversation is an article here by Anik, A-N-N-I-E-K. I can't even tell if that's the guy or girl. Anik Bo, B-A-O. So there's a name. China's factory activity unexpectedly contracts in November. Missing estimates, private survey shows. The rating dog China general manufacturing PMI, the rating dog China general manufacturing PMI fell to 49.9, missing analyst expectations of 50.5 in a Reuters poll. There's a Reuters poll of China manufacturing. Evidently, the private survey reading slowed from 51.2 in September and 50.6 New orders exported at the quickest pace in 8 months. New export orders, but other stuff. Domestic consumption was down, evidently. So according to this, you know, so these are the guys I'm talking about. John, who the hell is Rating Dog China General Manufacturing?
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
And who does Anik Bo work for?
CNBC. Or that's the article was printed. So it's a CNBC article. So I don't know what that means, but it's the official manufacturing PMI released on Sunday. This is the Chinese stuff. Shows China's factory activity shrank for the 8th month in a row, coming in at 49. So they were actually very close, the China one and these guys. So I don't know what that means.
I'm looking at.
Anyway, so they're not. I don't think. There's a worldwide slowdown. It's not just them. It's nowhere near just them. I mean, I think we're slowing down here too. So I don't know what that all means.
What is your sense? I mean, I'm much more interested in the Asian economies than I am the U.S. What is the U.S.? What do our numbers show?
I think we have a very bifurcated economy, and I think the gross numbers, because of the money we're pouring into the system, show pretty good. But I think the individual people, because of the prices going up in some areas, I think the amount of money being spent by the top 10% versus the bottom 90 is dramatically high. It's almost reaching the 1920s sort of a split, which is pretty scary. I mean, you see what the agricultural community is doing. They're in real bad shape. I mean, the price of it was a couple of good years with the soybeans and the corn and all the. Well, the price of seed and everything went way up, and all of a sudden the price of corn and soybeans is way down again. I think they're. What did Greg Pappas say, Jimmy, when he was helping us out with the show before he got his new job? Where are we? We're 2025. Was it 2023? Jimmy, the average farmer made $250,000, median. And then what did he say? Last year he thought it was going to be 65. I don't know if it's positive this year. If it is, it's very
small. Why aren't these guys, why don't they have pitchforks in hand and going after their latest town hall, going into the latest town hall? I mean, why are...
Some of them are. You know, some of them are. What's the... I mean, I just was watching a YouTube thing. Now, of course, you watch those things, but they had a group from Arkansas, and Arkansas does not, you know, they don't have the same kind of... I mean, Illinois, you can get... Now, God, when we started the business, my brother Dan, who's been a president of PTI for a long time, used to trade corn options over the Board of Trade floor. And and you know, he knew Dan, of course, knows everything about everything he's doing. So, you know, it was rare for a farmer to get 200 bushels an acre. Well, now it's in Illinois, in Iowa, it's the crummy farmer that doesn't get 200 bushels an acre. 210, 220 is the norm almost. Well, Arkansas, I don't think you get that. Well, anyway, these guys are talking about the average farmer is losing like $400,000 or something. And there was a huge town hall meeting where the government comes by, and you know, the government is involved in a lot in farming.
Yeah.
They have a meeting every quarter or something. They normally get five people. They had like there were lines around the block. I mean, what are we going to do? Is there a floor on this stuff? I mean, there is some sort of a floor in a lot of these people, but you know, it's bizarre. This is how it shows you how the government works. They have all these price supports and they have all these programs. I mean, you know, and I don't know how many have expired or don't, but there was one program they had in Indiana. This has to be 20 years ago because Dan was still on the trading floor. And where they gave, somehow encouraged people or gave people money to buy puts instead of actually selling the futures. Because what happens is if you, normally, what the farmer does, I guess I'll explain this for a second. You put your corn on the ground, you think everything's cool, and the price is $3 a bushel. All of a sudden, it runs to $3.50. You can sell futures for $3.50. You know, you better not sell them for the exact amount of bushels you have, because if something goes wrong with your harvest, then you get a problem. But the theory of it is, if it goes to $4. It's kind of okay because you lose 50 cents on the future, but now you're selling your corn for $4. So the futures price versus your cash price should move in tandem in theory. Now, it depends on where you are, what's your basis, those kinds of things, but it's way too complicated for this morning. And the idea was, well, instead of doing that, because people were pissed off because a couple of years, you know, the price was $3. They sold the futures at three, or they thought they would get $3. They sold the futures at $3.50, and all of a sudden the futures ran to $6 or something. So now the 1 year you could have really made out like a bandit, you didn't, because you locked your price in at $3.50. So the idea was, why not just buy puts at the $3 number? Say you paid whatever you paid for them, and if the corn went down to $2, you at least made money on the puts, and that way you didn't truncate your upside. Evidently, it was a couple of years, and it was a very successful program. And somebody goes, "No, we don't want to do that. We want all these programs back or something. We like the programs better than just having people buy puts." And it, you know, and it never, that has not come back in again. But the people in Arkansas, I think they had some drought down there. Yeah, you have to be real careful, because if you're going to get 100,000 bushels of corn, it's 5,000 bushels per contract. So if you sell 20 contracts of corn and all of a sudden you get a hailstorm over your farm and you don't have anything to deliver and the price goes up, you got a real problem. So you have to be very careful with how many. Now, if you'd bought the puts, that wouldn't be an issue. You'd eat the money on the puts, and oh, by the way, you'd probably eat the money that was in the ground, but you wouldn't be stuck for a couple of bucks a bushel on top of that. I know this is getting kind of way too complicated, but there's all kinds of programs you can use. But right now, I think the agrarian part of the country, it doesn't help all the export problems with China. Soybean guys, especially in the northern part of the range. Now, John, I don't know how much you know about the basis part, but if you're growing soybeans in Chicago or in Illinois or Iowa, you deliver them overseas, you're going to put them on probably a rail car or a container of some kind. You're going to get them to the river. You're going to get them on a barge, and you're going to New Orleans, and you're going someplace. So the whole filtering system is down the river. If you're not just, or you could be selling it here. I mean, we obviously use a lot of soybeans here too, and corn. We have our own. We have the crush here, you know, where you make the corn oil and you make the meal.
The ethanol.
Yeah. Well, you do some of that. I don't know if it's as big as it was, but an ethanol plant is nothing more than a big still. I mean, you essentially, if you added one more piece to the end of the ethanol, you could drink it, right? It would just be corn whiskey. Not very good corn whiskey, but you could do it. But that whole part of the economy is in disarray. And I think a lot of your small manufacturing is getting there, yet you have some places that are doing exceptionally well. And, so that's a problem. It's a 1920s problem. We don't want it to end the way it did in the 20s, though, do we? At all. Because we don't know how that ended, not so hot. So, but yeah, you have to be real careful with all this stuff. And when you have a transactional group, in Washington, if they make money, the whole world's making money. Well, that's interesting, but sometimes you have to look around, right? You got to get out of the limousine, as they say.
Well, the one thing that China does have that is an advantage is that the party. The party knows if it does not deliver, economic growth is the most important thing above all, period. And they know that if they don't deliver it, then people will take to the streets. And people we just don't report it. Okay, and they hush it up.
Well, Jim, what happens to all these people that have these cities, these ghost cities, where they actually have a mortgage? And over there, from what I understand...
Oh, they are, it's... first of all, the building can collapse and you still have to pay the mortgage.
Well, that's okay. What I'm saying. I mean, here... If you have... we have Mr. Flanagan. John, join us up, will you? There's right where Audrey lives in Orland. They have... there's a big... I guess it might have been a cornfield, but... anyway, these guys bought the property and they're making this, whatever you want to call it, development. And there's condos and there's a couple single-family homes and townhouses, and the guy did a nice job. He's been working on it for several years, but if you decide you want one of those places, you might, have to put $10,000 down or something to hold your spot. But you don't take delivery and start paying a mortgage until the place is done, and if all of a sudden it doesn't. I guess if it totally blew up, I suppose you could lose your $10,000. I'm not, I don't know how that works. That's a Mr. Flanagan question. But by and large, you're not held to anything until the thing is done and you take title of it. So you don't start paying your mortgage until you're
free. I'll tell you, in many countries in Asia, it is very draconian. It's not that at all.
So they start,
you get a mortgage, you start paying right away.
Yeah, start paying right away, and if you never move in, you're still paying. I don't know, Mr. Flanagan, well, say hello. How does that even? Who thought of that? It's a great deal if you can get it, I suppose.
Morning, everyone.
Hi.
Well, you know, that's, I guess there is a sense of fairness that governs, you know, buying property and building on spec or whatever in this country that is unheard of, you know, in a lot of other places, that you can't be held responsible for paying for something that doesn't exist yet, and, you know, being saddled with the burden of owning it without any of the pleasure, you know, pleasure or conveniences associated with it. But that's standard in China and elsewhere. You know, you buy it. If it never gets built, you're still paying for it.
The Philippines has issues there too.
It's
a whole concept of a title, and I don't know. You'll get me going here in a second, but yeah, no, it is. You know, people can get really stung there.
Who dreams this stuff up? I guess it's so. Okay, so now somebody has a place. It never gets finished. And you're paying this mortgage. Who the hell are you paying the mortgage to?
The banks.
So the bank lends the guy the money for the place. He never finishes it, so that money's gone. He absconds with it. And you're essentially paying the money that this guy took off with? That's kind of weird.
Yeah, well, the banks take off, you know, and it's not unusual. It's died down a little bit where the banks will take off. The owners of the bank, they just close the door. And they take off. That's why they, especially in China, they're so susceptible to runs on the bank. There was the very famous case that you'll read about bank runs. I mean, so if there's a rumor that there's a run on the bank or a bank's in trouble, people will flock, you know, just a rumor, because there's no real control and no one trusts the government there. And the old story in Hong Kong is...
Do they have FDIC at all, John?
What's that?
Is there such a thing as FDIC?
No.
Oh.
Not at all. Wow.
No. And so in Hong Kong, it was raining one day, and people were standing, you know, right next to the building. There was an awning. The building happened to be, whole, you know, there was a bank there. People think there was a bank run, so all of a sudden there was like 1,000 people outside the bank. When it was really people just trying to keep out of the rain.
There's no central bank that's a banker of last resort, nothing like that.
No. Not for individuals, no.
Well, what no. the hell?
The government does bail out a lot of businesses because they don't have a choice. Now remember, you know, there's the central government and the local government. And the local government does it a lot more than the central government. Because the local governments are... We think of China as a monolith. That's not true.
Yeah, but the
local governments are very powerful, and they're the ones that are playing a lot, you know, half the financial shenanigans.
But they can't make money like the Fed can. A local government, the state of Illinois can try to bail a bank out, but they're gonna have to bail them out with real cash, not with made up money.
Yeah. So what they do is they play games with the real estate. They play games with forgiving loans that they put out there. That's how they do it.
And with no fairness in how those, you know, perks are allocated. You know, that the friends or the ones who are closest to the party leaders or whatever can escape scot-free, and other people are left holding the bag.
I'm just kind of curious if you trace the check. Why do I always get down to this? Me, Mr. Cost accountant mentality. If you buy a place here, okay, and you're living in it or not, if you rent wherever you do, and you the builder is long gone at this point, because the mortgage you got paid off the builder or the person who was in the house before you, so now you personally have this loan on something you have that you have title to, so you're paying off the loan on that piece of property, and there's a, you know, there's a what do you call it? The bank has first dibs on that. They have they really have the deed. You don't. I can see how that works. But if the guy never finishes it and he's gone, where exactly does your check go? I mean, to what? Paying your loan off for what? But with the banks, I guess the bank still owns the deed to the place, but the place isn't worth anything.
The government, you know, in that parlance, the government has the deed, you know, in everything in China. I mean, the government owns
everything. They own it, right.
So we can't translate our idea that you know, real property is transferable among private citizens and you can hold it in perpetuity once you get it. And, you know, the government can take it by eminent domain and so on, but they have to reimburse you, you know, in some formula for the use of that property to take it from you. But it's never really, you know, out of the hands of the government in China. It's really, you know, it's sort of a hybrid system of, you know, like a long lease that can be,
many of those places, it's you don't own it. It's a 99-year lease.
Right.
Well, we have places here.
You know, gentlemen, I apologize, but I'm going to have to take my daughter to the airport.
Right. Hey, so, give yourself some time. It's horrible getting in her this morning, supposedly.
I will tell you, I had to take a friend to the airport Saturday night, and that was an experience. It was like the days of old.
Well, I drove out to Orland, and all he heard about, they were interviewing all the guys doing the plows and stuff. All the guys must have been doing, they all must be being interviewed, because I was on the Stevenson, the Ryan, and LaGrange Road, and not one of them had been touched. That did not by a plow or by a salt truck. I mean, I don't know what that
was. Saturday night, these guys were lined up, four on the freeway blocking the traffic, and everybody was behind them. I thought I was in Desert Storm or something. It was pretty impressive. So this
well,
is on
Sunday
the
morning, everything was pretty cleaned off.
Yeah. All right, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Take care,
talk
John.
Soon.
So,
all
John,
right.
There I was. You know, Audrey's got this big driveway, so somebody must have been an old boyfriend of hers or something. But every time a guy plows 151st Street, he comes around a corner and drops all the snow from 151st Street, you know, the real heavy stuff, right at the end of her driveway. After you've got it all cleaned off, then all of a sudden you can't get out, right? Well, you can get out, but you don't want it to turn into ice because you'll never get out while tearing somebody's car apart. So her snowblower was not up to the task, and I'm going, oh, God, well, I suppose I could get a shovel, but I don't know if I'm quite that young. All of a sudden, the guy next door comes out with a much bigger snowblower and mows right through it. The guy next door, he's an immigrant from India. Terrific guy. He and his wife are both got two or three degrees and in the medical world and terrific people. And of course, the kid is like number one in his class somewhere at University of Illinois, and he's going to Wisconsin's med school is up in Green Bay. I didn't know that. Did you? Or one of them? That's the higher end one.
No.
He's actually at University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. And so I said to the dad, I go, how's his son doing up there? Is it not a whole lot of fun in Green Bay? He goes, what's the difference? All he does is study. He's either in the lab or doing something. He goes, he doesn't have any time to go anywhere anyway. It might as well be cold. I go, well,
yeah, that's a good incentive to stay to the
yeah, good incentive.
Book, so.
But he had there used to be a show on in Minnesota on Friday night. It was like an hour show. It was a call-in show. It was like, you know, the one here, it was like Trick My Ride, where you're calling about your car.
Yeah.
This was all about your snowblower. But, you know, one guy, I don't know, somehow I got it because Bridget, John's wife, Dr. J's wife, Bridget McGrath, you know, tricked me into this show. So I turned it on. You could actually get it here. And it was a riot, these guys calling. One guy took a motor out of like an old Volkswagen, an air-cooled motor, made a snowblower with that. He was talking about how much snow he could blow up with that thing. But they also have a term. Did you ever hear the term Gus?
No.
We were out skiing, and of course we get like a foot of snow in the driveway, and you know, we're young and strong at the time. We grab a couple of shovels and we make short work of that. Well, I get to the end, and I, you know, flip the stuff up like you do here in Chicago, and Bridget says to me, Tommy, you're gussing. And I go, I'm doing what? She goes, you're gussing. All right, Bridge, you got to let me. Evidently, I mean, here, you shovel the snow, you assume before the next snowstorm comes, you know, some of this is going to melt, right? Which is kind of where we are in Chicago. Not all the time, and then you got a problem that winter. But most of the time, you're going to get a little, you know, a 35-degree day, and you're going to be good to go till the next snowstorm, right? Up there, they don't think anything like that. So the idea is you make it to the absolute end of the sidewalk plus a little more. Because you can't, what the gust means, give up space. So if you give up like an inch of your sidewalk this snowstorm and another inch the next snowstorm, pretty soon you have no sidewalk by the middle of January. So you can never give up space. You got to take the entire sidewalk every snowstorm. Isn't that bizarre?
That's a good term. I got to remember that one.
Yeah. So when you're out there shoveling, tell a neighbor, don't be gussing on me. You know? So, John, what do you make of all the... We have all kinds of stuff going on. Here's one I thought you might... You got to be careful, but no man can do one thing. Fewer international students are enrolling at U.S. colleges, which could cost the country $1 billion. 17% less people this year. Well, what do you make of that? These are all bad people, or what are we doing?
I think a lot of educational institutions here have lost sight of, you know, the mission of educating people here, for starters. I mean, I think that's just been completely thrown out the window at a lot of these universities, and I can see why. You know, it's a real rat race for money and government money, let alone private money. So if it means you have to reserve a certain percentage of your student population for, you know, people from outside the country, and make them pay full freight, and then be, you know, as stingy as you want to be with financial assistance to people who are here and applying for admission, if that's the game, well, you know, eventually you start serving the ones that, you know, are paying you the most money, and that the balance easily tips away from the people here, which doesn't make much sense, especially with, you know, public institutions. But I'm all for giving them priority when it comes to admission.
Well, they claim that these are the altogether, this is the U.S. Department of State and whatever, international students contribute $55 billion to the U.S. economy in the 24-25 academic year, including tuition revenue and as well as student spending. I'm not, you know, without casting any ideas to whether that's right, wrong, or in the barrel, it's a number. And, you know, and the question is, how are we going to... There's a lot of people in these college towns where the foreign people eat burgers just like everybody else, right? And you can't knock all this stuff out of everybody's thing because you have this hard-on for people overseas. I'm not saying it's not partially correct or anything like that, but I'm saying you at least need to look at the number and say, what am I doing? And if all of a sudden you have three or four places closed and everybody else is having a rough year, at least you should sort of expect it is all I'm saying. Or whether you still go ahead and do it or not, you know, that's policy. And maybe enough people want to do that, and, you know, they don't ask me. But the point is, you at least should recognize that when you do this, it's going to leave a mark on somebody, right? It's all I'm asking, and I don't see
it. Well,
that.
It's already leaving a mark, Tom. I mean, you look at what's, you know, where the U.S. elite educational system, you know, the Ivy League universities, you know, the big, powerful state universities, have long ago sold their souls to research money or handshake deals with foreign governments and foreign elites, so that if any two-bit diplomat in China or some other countries is worth their salt, they're going to get a spot at a U.S. university, and it, you know, it can be used to tout the diversity credentials of these schools here, but they become businesses that are really operating for the elites all around the world. And, you know, that's the price you pay for having at one time an enviable education system, like the U.S. university systems were at one time. I think it's much less the case now. But, you know, of course that translates to, you know, people paying money here, you know, for, you know, hamburgers and whatever else. But there's a much bigger concession made in reserving spots for elite business people, political people elsewhere, who aren't particularly interested in coming back here to invest or, you know, share any of that wealth. And the people left here, you know, who have to scrounge for whatever positions they can get in the second, third tier institution, because all the other ones are gobbled up by the powerful from everywhere else in the world. That doesn't make any sense to me. That isn't any way to run a system.
But why do we, part of this is, you would expect, if you look at things from the economic end, which I always do, which is a strength and a weakness, I understand that. If you look at things from the economic end, in any other type of competition, in most places, for instance, you go buy gasoline. Last week when I was coming back from that military funeral, I don't know what happened there, John, but every place was 349 except one place was 267. I don't know if they just gotten the, because the oil prices have gone down, if they just got their new truckload or whatever.
Were they lined up around the block?
Oh, it was pretty mad. And everybody's going inside, yeah. Coming out. They had a Dunkin' Donuts there. Everyone inside bought something. Guys are coming out with six packs of beer. I mean, not only does it help the gas, but those places make way more money, I think, on the store than they do the gas. But anyway, that's another. But there's no, help me out here, you two wordsmiths. There's no stigma to the gas of 267. It's the same gas as across the street, right? But here, you would think if competition, it's our own, not our own, you, the three of us, or the listeners, it's people's, I don't know, snoot in the air, or whatever you want to call it. I mean, if, for instance, I think I've heard from a million people, not a million people, but several people, way less than a million, that one of the best accounting and business schools undergrad around is Northern Illinois, that they have one of the better accounting schools around. Now, obviously, the finance school down at Champaign is very difficult to get in, just like their engineering program. If you want to get down there and take agriculture, you get in tomorrow, right? Or you want to take English, you get in tomorrow. But if you want to take finance or you want to take engineering, you get a real problem getting in Illinois, from what I understand. Yet, it should just be just as easy for a lot less money, hell, you can even commute, to go to Illinois and get your degree. Yet, but the world, the business community, gives the big snort down on that degree versus Illinois. Now the question is why. That's kind of what does it. I mean, I don't know that a Harvard education is any better than University of Illinois or Loyola or someplace at an undergrad level. Grad schools, maybe they get better people in law school or stuff. I don't know, but yet if somebody comes in from Harvard, it's almost like you're people are buying the selection process. They're not buying the education. They're not buying the person. The guy from Harvard must be better than the guy from Loyola, but he may or may not be. He comes out of undergrad with a accounting degree. What the hell is the difference?
That is the mindset, because you're buying into, you know, a lifelong, you know, preferment, because you've got a credential that is assumed to be one you work very hard to get, and, you know, entitles you to be, you know, given, you know, preferences over somebody who doesn't have that particular credential. I could see this, you know, remember how it used to be, Tom, and even, you know, universities like, you know, like ours, Notre Dame and Loyola and DePaul, places I have, you know, been firsthand knowledge of here. At one time, if you went through those programs, you know, or professions or whatever, you were considered, you know, eminently hireable by those same institutions if it came to a tenure track job.
Yeah.
So, and there was no stigma attached to the fact that you had a degree from the institution who you were hoping to get a job with. But that had all changed by the time I was in grad school. And, you know, Loyola, for example, and this is not to badmouth any of these places, it just shows kind of what happened with, you know, academia and, you know, the sort of the rat race that took over. But if you had a Loyola degree, you were never on anybody's list at Loyola for any position for a tenure track job, unless it was a very small, you know, boutique kind of program that there wasn't a whole lot of people qualified to apply for. So you just had to take your credentials elsewhere and go to someplace less important than Loyola and hope to get a job, because Loyola's ranks were being filled up with Princeton grads and Harvard grads and Brown grads. I mean, this is, you know, the way they kind of touted their, you know, ability to attract, you know, people to their programs. Look at the faculty we have. Look at their credentials. Look at where their degrees are from. And it carries a lot of weight. And it carries more weight overseas than it does here, let me tell you. But it's a terrible, you know, thing when the university hands you a diploma and says that entitles you to a lot of things, but not a job here. that to me was the ultimate.
Yeah, I never could quite get the, I mean, some of it is a selection process. The idea being, if I hire somebody from Harvard, I'm not just buying the person, I'm buying the fact that Harvard took one out of 100 people. I mean, that's
right.
That's essentially what you're buying. But I never was all that big on that, to be honest with you. I mean, I never was. You know, the place that kind of messed some of that up was Notre Dame forever. If you were in pre-med at Notre Dame, they used to mark on a curve. Can you imagine that now? That if you came out of there, the pre-med program with a B average, you got into a med school. Well, somewhere along the line, when we were in school, Jen, the grade creep everywhere else, it got to the point where everybody else has got an A-minus average. I think there was a time when some of our friends had trouble getting into school. That I would have put them up against anybody. But the idea that you have, 100 people there, all of them pretty smart, and oh, by the way, you got to make sure that half of them get C's, well, that doesn't cut it in today's world. I mean, nobody wants anybody getting C's, even though a C in one place might be an A somewhere else. I mean, it's, I don't get it. Hey, you want to?
Yeah, at least my institution when I was teaching did flunk people out. I don't think Harvard flunks out anybody.
No,
for poor grades, because who's getting or giving poor grades at Harvard? It's expected that you don't receive them, and if you're on the staff or a faculty member, it's presumed you don't give them. So it's all been kind of arranged in a way so you're immunized from the pressures that somebody at a much less prestigious institution has to suffer through every day in every course, and that's taken a toll on the education quality. In ways we can't even calculate. So,
the difference between being, I don't know, it's a mentality, Jen, and I'm sure as hell not going to say which one's right or wrong, but the difference is, in Notre Dame, I don't know of anybody who ever bitched at a professor about a grade or a test was unfair or anything. You never even thought of questioning it. And I never went to the only time I went to a professor's office was senior year when I wanted to take a grad class, and I asked the guy if an undergrad could get into the grad class, and he looked at my record and he said, you can do it. He was a terrific guy. Remember Bonello?
Oh yeah, I didn't meet him or know him, but I don't remember.
He was a terrific guy, and what a great. The only thing that pissed me off is he wouldn't let me out of the final. For those, if you were a senior at Notre Dame and you had an A average going into the final, the deal was that you didn't have to take the final. That was like a, kind of a gift to you for
like
doing
a gentleman's agreement.
Gentleman's agreement. So this was a grad class. So I went in, and of course now I'm playing golf every day. I wanted to, but this is the middle of May, so you only had like 3 good weeks of weather in South Bend before you got out of there. I mean, so I said, hey, can I dance on the final? He goes, here's the deal. He goes, you're the first undergrad that I let in my class, and a few people were not happy that I did that. We've had 2 tests so far. You've gotten an A on both of them. I'd like to be able to tell these people that it worked out, letting a guy in from the... So as a favor to me, would you mind taking the final? And I said, well, when you put it that way, I'll be here. And I did well in the final, and he thanked me for it. He was now, if somebody ever questions me for doing something, I could say, wait a minute, I let one guy in and a guy got an A, so lay off me, basically. So, but maybe you do stuff for people, right? All you had to do is ask me to do it. What was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid? And he goes, you just told Sundance to get out of here. And he's, well, what has to happen? He won't leave until you ask me to stay, remember?
Yeah.
But sometimes you... Hey, I don't want to get out too far down this road on this shooting in Washington, because it's obviously still going on as to what is happening or not happening. But John, you were part of our whole thing here regarding issues with veterans, PTSD, all that kind of stuff. And we had, for a 10-day period, I think about as good a reporting as I've seen anywhere, not just on Stocks and Jocks, because the people here came from so many different perspectives. You had Diane Kelly talking about she's working with veterans people now, and now she's working with people that, well, she's not, but in the hospital up at Great Lakes, they have active duty people there as well. And she was talking about all the psychological issues and so forth. Then we had Dr. Johnson came on, who actually did his work in psychology through the Army. They're the ones that put him through, psychology, shrink school, I'll say. And then he did a lot of work at veterans' places. Then Kenny and Talia came on and talked about their thing with the Headstrong group. And, you know, we put this whole kind of package of stuff together. And all of a sudden, this guy drives from Washington State to Washington and blasts two people that he never met in a National Guard. And I'm going, what the hell is that? Why would, first of all, why would you go all that way passing all the other National Guards people along the way and blast these two people? I mean, so then I started reading something about this guy, and it turns out he was a part of this unit. You know, those that, you know, the Afghan thing for a lot of people now is fading into history, sort of like Vietnam. But there's still a lot of these people around. And evidently this guy was called, he was one of the zero units the CIA hired. And, I assume this kind of stuff went on, but you don't really know, John. How could you? And the guy was in this unit for like 8 years. Not two or three, but eight. And he was working with the Taliban, targeting people, doing this stuff. All kinds of like the dirtiest stuff you could possibly do in his own country for 8 years. And evidently, a lot of these guys have been led into this country because they were on our side. And the Taliban was going to take, you know, all kinds of vengeance against them. So they're here. They said the units were exclusively composed of Afghan nationals and operated the umbrella of the National Directorate of Security, or NDS. The intelligence agency established with CIA backing for Afghanistan's previous U.S.-backed government. They were considered by the U.S. and its international partners to be the most trusted domestic forces in Afghanistan. These units were often labeled death squads by human rights groups. The units were known in Afghanistan for their secrecy and alleged brutality, and members were implicated in numerous extrajudicial killings. Whatever, there's a word, right? Extrajudicial. That means no trial, John, I think. Killings of civilians.
No, nothing other than premeditation.
Particularly during night raids. The U.S. official briefed on the investigation, confirmed the suspect had been disturbed by the casualties in his unit and, more recently, deepened by the killing of his close friend overseas. So evidently, it was not only was it kind of known to our people, but another article, of course, I can't find. There's a guy, sort of like Talia, who somehow or another has come upon this fact that the Afghan people that we have over here, that basically we had blasting their own countrymen for 8 years, have a higher percentage of PTSD than just a regular army person that was over there, which I suspect wouldn't surprise me at all, or you either. And he was trying to get money to do something for this, and he not having much luck. Sort of like, you know, Kenny and Diane. You know, where do you get the money? Where do you get the stuff to be recognized? Same thing that Dr. Johnson was talking about. So, you know, I think you know me well enough to know no matter what your problems are, it doesn't give you the right to go shoot somebody else. I mean, I'm never going to justify that. But when are we going to wake up and realize the problems here? I mean, I just looked up, Diane mentioned the amount of suicides among veterans here. So I don't think you should blow somebody else up, obviously. But if you just blow your own head off, it's okay? I mean, why don't we recognize the problems we cause here, either in wars we already were in or before we get into another one? I mean, do we have any clue on this, or we don't even care? I mean, where are we on this?
Well, you know, the intelligence operation, or, you know, counterintelligence operation you're describing is, you know, it's got all of the associated PTSD issues when you put people through horrendous, you know, moral situations, and it pretty much erased their, you know, their moral hierarchy for whatever objective you want them to work for. And then when you just simply expect these people to come back here as, you know, permanent residents or citizens or whatever path you allow them to follow after they get here, and assume that everything is going to be, you know, normal, is naive at best and you know, criminal at worst. But I also think there's an element to this, that once you start working for operations like that in your own country, and then you are taken away and put somewhere else, you know, it's comparable to a witness protection racket.
Pretty much.
It isn't like what you did doesn't carry consequences with the people who know who you were and what you did and where you are. So in a sense, you are never out of this operation. You are never a true civilian ever again. I think that's the way with a lot of, you know, intelligence, you know, employees who, you know, are still working for, you know, the farm, but not, you know, having none of the trappings of it, but you're still under control and you're constantly being ratted out or hunted down. And, you know, there's revenge operations against these people. And you're also still useful to the intelligence people who know all about you. They know exactly what you were doing and whose control, you know, made you do that. And, you know, I just don't see how these people can walk away and separate themselves from that. I think they're still under the thumb of somebody at the top.
Well, you know that, and I think I'm learning that. Obviously, Talia knows that. Diane knows that. Dr. Mark knows that. Why do we continue to just say, well, hopefully they'll just blow themselves away?
Well, that isn't even part of the calculus. They don't care if these people destroy themselves. They have enough people. They can just, you know, move up the ranks and consider, you know, the next, you know, group of people that they can rely on for whatever task they have. Because you never really are not off of their payroll, even if you're not getting paid by them. You're still, you know, liable to do their bidding. And you can't just walk away, either because of your own personal problems or because of the fear that you have of people coming after you for what you did. And the exquisite timing of all this stuff with, you know, the week before with the six, you know, intelligence and military people producing that video that apparently John Brennan produced or wrote the script for or advised writing the script for, and they all just read somebody's script. I see it as all part of something that's a little too synchronized for comfort. And I don't think this guy was an independent actor. I don't think he was just, you know, lost his mind and, you know, something reactivated and he drove cross country to do this thing in the nation's capital. I think it was calculated as part of that same program to stir up some kind of, you know, fear or, you know, retaliation against having the National Guard in various cities.
Well, he drove right by the National Guard in Portland.
But you know, it's more important to the people planning this to have it done blocks from the White House than it is someplace else. It's all part of an intelligence operation itself, then, is what I'm saying. And I don't trust the guy, the fact that the guy was just doing this because he...
Well, that's what I mean. If you're going to do something crazy, it seems like a long stretch. I'd say if I wanted to, first of all, I don't get the connection between what the CIA did to him over there and the National Guard. I guess I could...
But there doesn't have to be any. That's just the assignment he's given. That's all.
Well, I mean, if he wanted to pull a Timothy McVeigh and pull an explosive device in front of the CIA office, not that I would want that to happen, at least there's a connection there that I could sort of, I won't say, not least, certainly not approve of, but I get no connection between where he was and these two people in Washington.
And that's what they would like us to imagine, and therefore to not pursue the idea that this was manipulated by intelligence itself. And the Timothy McVeigh example is really not a good one to use, because clearly that guy thought he was doing something and other people concluded he did something else. And the way the FBI handled that investigation and the way that the prosecution of that, under Merrick Garland, by the way, who, before anybody heard of him on the national stage, he was the one behind the McVeigh prosecution and the quick execution and all that stuff, you know, surrounding the wrap-up of that, the whole thing.
Well, we're going to use this as an excuse to throw out all immigrants. We didn't use that as an excuse to get all white guys out of Idaho.
Not that time. It was to demonize militia groups and people like David Koresh, you know, all this stuff that was, you know, had already been brewing.
Well,
so it was not about, you know, demonizing immigrants.
Well, do we think it was him
demonizing American citizens?
I mean, was it? Well, okay, was it him and his buddy who's still in jail somewhere? I mean, I would. After that happened, my first thought was, gee, how many other people like this are in Idaho or North Dakota behind a barbed wire fence that are Looney Tunes as well?
Well, that's just what they wanted you to think.
Well, why wouldn't you think that?
Well, of course, they don't plan these things to have no result. They want them to have a specific why.
Who do you think they protected by offing the guy that quick?
The fact that he had nothing to do with the bombing in Oklahoma City, for starters.
You didn't think he did?
No.
Why, that's the first time I ever heard that. Didn't he drive a truck up to the place?
He drove a truck, but the stuff he had in that truck could not have inflicted the damage on the building that resulted.
Really?
Yeah. It's the same thing with 9/11.
It was a whole cement truck full of stuff, wasn't it?
It was a
concrete mixer. The thing was turning.
But it had some kind of like petroleum based.
Yeah, but he had a boatload of it in there. Those things hold like how many thousand pounds? It was fertilizer and something. Everything wasn't the thing leaking and everything else by the time they got it there.
Yeah, but when you looked at the destruction of the building and the quick demolition of the building, Tom, I mean, that happened in...
I'm with you on that. I mean, the whole thing happened pretty quick, but...
And the same thing with selling all the steel out of 9/11.
But it was a pretty serious bomb that he drove up in. You imagine...
Yeah, it was some kind of a device, but there's no evidence that I've ever been satisfied with that he was the instigator or the agent behind the destruction of the building to that extent and the loss of life.
I never heard that, but you're probably right. I mean,
but you know, 2 months later, the thing was demolished. You know, and you think that's a major crime scene, Tom.
Well,
they got the guy they wanted, and they let go the guys they wanted to let go as part of that investigation.
Okay, but I thought the thing had been so damaged, they were worrying about it falling down. It really nailed a lot of the front girders of the place.
Well, the whole thing was like carved out as a horseshoe shape. Perfectly symmetrical.
So you're saying you're going to left it there for the next big windstorm? I don't know about that.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the thing was probably rigged in the same way that the towers in 9/11 were rigged, too. That, you know, the first responders in the building heard synchronized explosions going off as, you know, the stuff was being blown out of the supports. That was their testimony. You know, never ended up in the 9/11 report.
Well, as did the Were you ever in that building?
No, I was not.
Very unique. And when it happened, only because I was there, not because I'm a stress engineer or anything like that. But there was no columns inside. There was the elevator bank, which obviously was supported in the middle, and then everything else was all around. Remember how close the beams were on the outside? It's actually the very same structure as the Standard Oil Building here, which is now what do they call that place?
The Aon Center.
Aon Center. It's the same sort of thing. The idea is you don't want internal columns breaking up your space, right? You want clear square footage. So if you walked over to the end of the place, the floor was hooked onto all these. You could actually lean over and look between the beams and almost look down. There was a space there. Matter of fact, one of the guys who was the head of Smith Barney, we were up in the, God, what a great place to have a drink. It was the windows of the world. You go up and get a drink, you look right out over the harbor and all the tugs and all the stuff going by, the Statue of Liberty, Ellis Island. I mean, it doesn't get any nicer than that. And you're having a drink, sitting at the bar, looking out over the harbor. So we walked over to the edge, and he got the super heebie-jeebies. He goes, oh my God, look at this. You can actually see a space. So once that fire started in that place, and you know, Dr. J and I were in the same office at the time, I go, John, they better get some water on this thing or that thing's coming down. Of course, John's response was, why do you think you know everything? I said, John, I don't know everything. All I know is if that one of those floors breaks loose, the floor below it is not designed to hold the weight of the floor above it. That building's going to come down if they can't cool that thing off somehow. And there was no water in the building. There was no water up top, like a tank up top or anything like that. And you would have thought there would have been some way you could fire hoses from one building to the other, but there wasn't. And it was the hotter it got, all that happened was one floor come down, the whole thing was going to come down, and it did. Because of the unique construction in there, they didn't need anything else. That was perfectly good because, metal of a certain amount of heat, metal will bend. And it did, and once one broke loose, you can imagine one floor was not designed to hold the weight of the floor above it, right?
So once that would make more sense to me, Tom, if Building 7, which was not built that same way, and was newer and was smaller, that it didn't
collapse. That's the one was across the street, right?
Yeah, it happened like 5 in the afternoon, and it was being reported on the BBC as having happened before it happened.
I was there a bunch of times, Jan, and there was one and two. The two big ones, and then there was the one next to it where the one hotel was in. Then there was one where the exchange floors all were. I don't remember. Now the seven, some of the seven were actually across the freeway over on the Harborside, right? It wasn't seven right there, I don't think.
Well, to look at the numbering of the buildings, you know, it really doesn't have anything to do with their proximity to each other. Tower 7, and I'd have to look at a map to remember my orientation of where it was, but it was, there were other things closer to Towers 1, I think, than
Tower 7. What was the Customs House? The Customs House was like four, and it wasn't even a tower, right? It was just one of the buildings?
Tower 7 had, you know, was IRS, and it had, you know, federal offices. But Tom, all three towers, 1, 2, and 7, were owned by the same person. So, and they're the three that collapsed that day. And one building collapsed that didn't have a plane supposedly fly into it, and didn't have the same architectural flaw that you were describing. So, you know,
well, it wasn't a flaw unless a plane ran into it.
What? But if you're saying when there was this gap between, you know, the exterior,
no, I'm saying the floor was attached right to the exterior walls. There was no internal. There were no internal support, so like it wasn't like one part was going to come down. It was going to come down. The whole floor was coming down. Very similar to, remember the earthquake they had in Mexico how many years ago? But it was all concrete, and as soon as one concrete floor dropped onto the other one, they all went down.
The same thing.
Same exact thing. No floor is designed to hold the weight of the floor above it. Why would it be? It was all just attacked.
It didn't pancake, Tom. The whole thing just moved in synchronized, you know, downward movement.
Well, that's what I'm saying. One floor on top of one floor on top of one floor, all the way down to the bottom, until they were all stacked better on the bottom.
But 9/11, both towers 1 and 2 collapsed in synchronization. It wasn't like one floor was above the other and crashing the other one below it, and then one after another, the whole thing went down.
Well, that's what you saw, the progression of one after another, just all the way down.
No.
But anyway,
physicists have made a real mess of this, Tom, and the crazy, you know, backflips they've done with, you know, how the fire was hot enough to do that kind of damage, and, you know, whether it was the architectural flaw or something else that caused this. But, you know, the eyewitness accounts and the collapse of Tower 7, none of which ever ended up in the final 9/11 report.
Oh, probably.
And the fact that ownership of these three buildings was the same.
You got to be careful with these reports, Dan. You don't want to put any truth in them. What good are they?
Well, you can't go around saying this, of course, without, you know, being looked at as if you got a tin foil hat on. But
well, I mean, but how many of those?
That's the problem too.
How many of those do you have?
Tin foil hats.
Yeah.
Look, I got a lifetime supply of it.
I think you and Wayne and Andrew got a bunch.
Well, but Tom, you know, the thing, this is what I was saying about what happened in Washington with the National Guard, and, you know, alluding to, you know, David Koresh and Oklahoma City and 9/11 too. They all had other objectives than just the destruction of something. And it was about to instilling fear in the general population about who was doing this and why they were doing it and how we've got to buckle down now and attack this kind of trouble at its source. So we get the whole procession of wars, you know, you're talking about in Afghanistan and Iran, because, or Iraq, because of 9/11, all the collateral damage of, you know, the suspicion of, you know, people in this country, whether it's the white supremacist movement, that, you know, they've ridden that horse about as far as they can, but that came out of the, you know, the Branch Davidians and, you know, the various, you know, standoffs between the government and, you know, the crazy right wing, and it was all about, you know, making people believe this was a much bigger problem than it probably ever was, but the belief is what they wanted, the fear is what they wanted, you know, they didn't care about the reality.
Well, nobody ever wants to take, I mean, obviously no one could ever have been a fan of Osama bin Laden, but he was another guy that we kind of gave the shaft to, didn't we? Wasn't he our guy when the Russians were fighting the Afghanis, and he was, as long as he was doing nasty stuff to the Russians, weren't we giving him?
Well, he was always our guy, and his family was took care of them after 9/11 too. We broke all the restrictions on air flight in order to get them out of the country.
So why do we constantly seem to have this somewhat of a, you know, I don't know, maybe we had a bunch of crooks when Abraham Lincoln was there, and why does there always seem to, no matter what happens, there's always this little bit of something. You're probably the only other person, maybe Carl, that after the second Iraq war, of course, we never seemed to, maybe we do, and we just don't have a chance to read it, But the Brits, you know, the Brits are different. Some good, some bad, I suppose. But like a year later, it was supposed to be like 6 months. They actually have kind of a rule on the book, of course, they don't ignore. Every time they do something like that, they have kind of a post-mortem. And it's probably around somewhere. I don't know if it's online or someplace. But they did like a summary of the Second Iraq War. Because they were talked into going in with us by Colin Powell and the rest of the group. They acted like good allies, right? And they wrote this thing that was absolutely scathing, John. It was about how screwed up the Americans were and how screwed up they were for believing us. And we had that one guy we thought was going to be the new president of Iraq. And as soon as he got there, he got out of there because they wanted to hang him. And he was the big consultant to Rumsfeld. They were paying him, and they thought the idea that the minute we knocked off Saddam, everything was going to sort of be okay. And the British in this report said that the people in the Cheney group spent more time divvying up what they thought was going to be the oil after it was over than worrying about who was going to run the place. They had no thought of very small thought about actually putting the government together, because they thought this guy would be acclaimed as president. And in fact, he got thrown out ahead of the noose. He was there like a couple of days. I mean, so the British are writing this thing. I'm reading him going, what the hell? Are we that bad, or is this just the British blaming it all on us? I don't know. But do we ever do anything like that? I mean, it's say, this is how we screwed up and why we should never have done this and how much it's going to... I mean, I know when it happened, there was a guy who wrote we weren't doing the show, but I was doing something with John, I think. There was a guy who wrote this cost estimate. He was talking about X number of people not getting killed, and unfortunately, they're cheap, right? Life is cheap, but he talked about a certain number of people that were going to be wounded, legs blown off, something, something. And he extrapolated the cost of that war going out the next 40 years while you're taking care of people. And he came up with like $1.5 trillion, where Bush's guys estimated what? 100 billion, 150 or something?
Oh, but well, he said that the war would pay for itself.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, with oil, but not for them, not for us.
Yeah, right. But think of all the other things, Tom. Remember, like, the looting of the museums in Iraq?
You know, yeah.
However that was, let happen or encouraged to happen, or who got the benefit of it, who looked the other way.
One thing I know, it wasn't you or me or Jimmy. That part I know for sure.
But that was all part of the lack of interest. You know, the bigger objectives were, this kind of crazy fantasy they had that, we could just put somebody in and run it, as our satellite state, and the people would be thrilled to have somebody there, unlike the horrible monster that we had supported all the years before that.
But you had who put that place together? Jimmy, you know something about it.
The U.S. has had a long history of backing the wrong person. You can go from Marcos, you can go from Vietnam, you can go further out, further back, further, Papa Doc.
The Shah of
Iran. We are horrible at it.
Well, when you say we, the people who make money at it probably did pretty well while those people were in there.
Oh, the people that, the money, probably, but as a government, we did back, Saddam because he was against Iran. And then when he went out, we backed some other guy. We're horrible at it. And I'm sure the British thing was, they were like, why did we ever do that? The United States is so bad at backing is so good at backing the wrong person.
Well,
it's
somebody's
hilarious.
By the way, Mike Murphy just texted in that when he says, we do after action reports all the time. And one thing, I mean, Mike's a great guest. But one thing he always talks about, Jean, is people, John and Jimmy, we blame the intelligence, and Mike, of course, was in intelligence, and he goes, they blame the intelligence, but they didn't read it, and they didn't follow it. I mean, I'm going to say Mike he's probably right.
Right, they ignore the intelligence. Yeah. They don't want to follow.
I'm sure there is an after-action report somewhere about the Second Iraq War. Just try and get it out of somebody's office in Washington. It can't be a good one, is it?
No, it's about cherry picking the intelligence you want to use, because you've already decided how you want to do this, and you ignore or discredit the stuff that is against it, or you know, put those people in other spots so you don't have to listen to their, you know, hand wringing about the wrong decisions you're about to make, and you just listen to the people who are telling you what you want to hear.
But why do we always we seem to have a I don't really understand some of the dynamics either, because I'm sure I could make the same mistake. But when we have people that somehow put together groups that wouldn't necessarily be best brothers. Now, I'm going to say, Jimmy, you were over there. Wasn't Iraq put together by a combination of T.S. Lawrence and Churchill?
Yes.
Pretty much. Didn't he draw? They draw most of those boundaries.
The maps were drawn by the British and the French.
And
that's correct. After the
okay,
French
so
war.
Now you have we put the Sunnis, the Shia, and the Kurds together in the same place, and it was run by a strongman, essentially, right? And
correct.
How do we not anticipate that if we yank the strongman? Not saying you want a strongman or anything, but for some, I guess they serve somewhat of a purpose, I suppose. If we pull the head off that, what makes us think that all the rest of the people are going to like have elections tomorrow and just all promise to get along? Didn't the same thing happen in Yugoslavia, Jimmy?
Yeah, same thing.
Exactly. Guess what?
I mean, the fact they had somebody like Tito made it work as long as it did. But once there was no Tito, look what happened.
That's why you got to have a guy like Flanagan running your neighborhood, some hotel Turian dude telling people. So, John, what is the, real quick, because we're going to have Audrey on in a second, probably zero into real estate. What is the, what's going to be the bottom line on these tax increases? I mean, you mentioned some for sale signs in your area. I know people that they're up 25-30%, and guess what? So what do they do? Is lob them out there? What if somebody can't pay? What do you do? What if you're in fixed income? What if you're on Social Security?
Well, that's what's happened in Harvey, for example. And Harvey has petitioned, you know, to have itself considered by the state of Illinois as a financially distressed municipality that is unable to handle its finances. And it's more than 50% of the people, the homeowners in Harvey, are not, you know, paying their real estate taxes, at least in full. And if you don't pay them in full, you know, it goes to a tax sale. It's accruing interest during the non-payment period. And if you get, you know, what, 3 consecutive years of non-payment, there's a forfeiture sale where you can, you know, some bidder can bid on the unpaid taxes and get title to the property fairly quickly, and you know, in the hope that this will now force, you know, the property to return to the tax rolls, you'll have somebody who is going to pay the taxes.
You just stole somebody's property.
Yeah, but you know, this is the way it's working in a lot of these distressed places. There's no master plan of getting enough people to buy distressed properties at tax sales and perform the taxes into the future. It isn't like you're having some infusion of, you know, a dramatic vision to improve the quality of life there, or the schools, or the lack of businesses, or anything else. So it isn't like these properties are ever going to be, you know, things you can depend on when it comes to tax revenue. Tom, that's what's happened to the Loop, and that's why, you know, the people on the south side and the west side are screaming bloody murder about how their taxes have raised, because it isn't like the beast stops, you know, taking food in. If they can't get the money from Loop tax bills, they'll you know, put the burden on other taxpayers in the county. And you know, a lot of the places that are screaming the loudest had depressed taxes by, you know, most standards in Cook County, and now that the comeuppance has happened, and I wouldn't be happy either. But as long as you have a downtown area that can't foot the bill like it used to, you're going to have this burden spreading out to ever increasing neighborhoods with ever increasing, you know, screaming and yelling.
Well, it's so, like Evergreen Park when the plaza went down.
Yeah. Well, it's the same.
You know, we're going to break here. We get Audrey on because I can rant on this one forever, but I'm going to give a 30-second rant. My criticism of a lot of this, John, has to do with maybe individual people. What exactly are we teaching in school these days? We have people in office at every level here. I mean, and people in other states too. Don't look to me like they have ever had a basic economics or business course. I mean, if you have, you should know as mayor, as president, as governor, when people are buying a house right now and the housing prices are high and income is that higher, that everybody who piles into this house, and a lot of people have a lot of money that might be their third or fourth. I'm talking about an entry-level person, and even somebody who's been there a little while, has kids and so forth. You pile in, and Nancy or Audrey will tell you, the last dime a lot of time is going into this place, especially for entry-level people. So if your taxes are $4,000 a year, and okay, we think I'm down to, what, $300-some a month, right? And all of a sudden it goes to $8,000. What makes you think that that person can pay the $8,000? So now if they can't pay the $8,000, or if you're, I guess if you're a mayor or a governor or a president, you don't care. If they can't pay the $8,000, now all of a sudden, after they put money down, it's going to go into this tax foreclosure thing. Got to help you if somebody loses a job. And all of a sudden, they're going to lose their house. Well, it's not because they couldn't pay what they expected to pay. It's because they couldn't pay some extraordinary amount that came on their way a year or two later. And I don't see how you can... I mean, I know somebody who's taxes went from $16,000 to $25,000. Okay, I guess you could say somebody owns a house that has a $16,000 tax bill should easily be able to pay the other $9,000. I don't know about that.
When everything else is going up.
Yeah, plus you know, before tax, what is $9,000? $16,000? $15,000?
Yeah.
I mean, do you know for a fact the person got a $16,000 raise last year and wants to give it all to you? I mean, how many people in your neighborhood now probably can't afford? We're going to go to Brigitte Buttery, let her talk about it, but she sold a house in Chicago Heights. John, every one of the tax bills was greater than the mortgage. Where are we going with this?
Anyway, it's not unusual now, Tom.
SP Futures down 46, and NASDAQ Futures down 243. We got to go to break because all kinds of stuff is happening here. I'll be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here.
We're back.
Lord up, back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe, Jim Lawler on the board. SP Futures down 45. NASDAQ Futures down 234. This was after a big move up last week, but still, it's a reasonable down day today here so far. Over in Europe, we have the DAX is down. European markets start December in negative territory. Is Airbus slides 10%. Not sure why that's down 10%, but it is. Individual stocks, not that much. JP Morgan's down $1.40. We got Nvidia down $2.34. United Health down $2.16. So not great. Meta's down $9.62. Google down $2.92. Tesla down $6.25. So the my machine, Jimmy, why don't you traffic weather sports? Our machine's a little grumpy here.
Okay. Well, in Phoenix today, it is 51 degrees, high of 72, and it will be sunny and pleasant. Unlike Chicago, which we at right now, it's 23 degrees, a high of 31, and we are under a weather advisory because we, again, will have possible snow this afternoon. In regards to travel times, let's update here real quick. The inbound Kennedy from the 290 Jane Byrne is at 42. The inbound from Montrose to the Kennedy is at 27. Eden's inbound from Lake Cook is at 41. The Eisenhower inbound from 290 from Thorndale is at 49. And the inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is at 29, showing that, yes, we are in. In sports, Bears win and are tied for the lead in the NFC. Notre Dame won. Now the question is, where will Notre Dame fall into? Because Texas beat Texas A&M, and they were number three. And again, I think Arch Manning is showing that he might be pretty good. I think the early Heisman stuff was too much stress or too much hype on the boy. Back to you, Chief.
I'm not even sure the Irish. Do we have Audrey? I'm not even sure the Irish are going to get in.
Projections are they will. Audrey is with us.
I don't know about these projections. What do you call it? What's a projection, John?
It's an imaginative.
Wishful thinking.
Yeah, wishful thinking, I think, is what that is. Odd, how are you?
Good morning. Just fine. How are you, gentlemen, today?
Gentlemen, use that term loosely.
I need to hear that this time of day.
Are you including John and Jimmy in that group or just me? Or is it I'm the one who's out?
I'll give you all a running start today. Go ahead.
Oh, good. Hey, we were talking a little bit before you came on, what, about some areas that were the taxes and some areas that might have lost, kind of a large. Just to give an example, when I was growing up, I mean, I was growing up at one time, the taxes in Evergreen Park were a lot cheaper, the property taxes, than in Chicago, because Evergreen Park had Evergreen Plaza, which was Rubloff's first major development, and it basically paid the nut for the whole place. And there were a lot of other businesses. And then all of a sudden the Plaza went down, and they gave all these deals to Menards and Walmart and those kinds of places. And now guess what? The taxes in Evergreen Park are higher in Chicago. So you get these kind of flips. But Odd, what causes, John was just mentioning, like a Harvey and Plymouth, what causes a Chicago Heights to be, I mean, I was out there with you. I wouldn't let Odd go out there by herself when she was showing a house out there. Not that I would have been able to stop a gang, but at least I felt better about it. How does a place get to where the mortgage is less than the taxes? I mean, how does something ever get that way? I mean, what does it do to you trying to sell a place?
Well, you know, it's an ongoing thing, and this is the dirty little secret the politicians don't want to talk about or address. And you claim you want to help your constituents, but you bury them under a mountain of debt, and I don't think any of them who live there have anything to show for it. This is a different subject, but boy, I'd love them to open the books in Illinois and be transparent about where that money's going. I think most people would be totally shocked. I think that's part of it. I would love to see the amount of wasted graft that's in that budget, that the people who live in these little towns that buy a house, and for most of them, it takes everything to do it. But the taxes have far outstripped their mortgage payment on these little homes. And most of these are great, solid little bungalow type of things, kind of things that, you know, we grew up in, that had taxes of maybe $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, and now have doubled or tripled. So besides the fact that a lot of these places have lost their business base, there's not a big commercial base to draw from. And so you'll see that happening, a lot in Madison, where, the mall's gone, a lot of the businesses are gone. But all these areas like Chicago Heights, the taxes are abnormally high for the value of the house. And I would love to see the local politicians and our governor address what's going on.
When you get your tax bill, I haven't got one for a while since I rent.
You would faint if you read all the itemizations, but I can't imagine.
Well, that's what I mean. What does it say? I mean, I'm going to guess the last time I looked, right around 50% is for schools, correct?
Yeah. Well, it depends where you live. But where I live, the schools are very highly rated. So, yeah, a huge chunk goes to the schools.
So you're gonna have that. So then it starts, you get down to the mosquito abatement district, it's like 2% or something. I mean, it's a huge mix, right?
I'd love to know where it's going.
I mean, I guess what I'm saying, doesn't it sort of tell you?
Yes, you have a whole list.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. What I guess the question I'm getting to, what percentage actually goes to the state? I don't think it's not that bit much, is it?
Well, if our next break, if you give me a minute, I'll go rummage through and pull out my tax bill and we can look at it.
Yeah, it gives excruciating detail now, you know, what the dollar amount of your tax bill that goes to the schools, that goes to libraries, to mosquito abatement, to the forest preserves. You know, it's all there now.
John, you forgot in Chicago, it goes, you get to find out how poorly funded our pensions are. That's the other thing that it shows up on your tax bills.
Right. Well, we could actually, you know what, next time you're on, Odd, let's do a walk down memory lane. When we first started the PTI, and the police funds, Odd, remember you going to all those places, seeing if we could get some business, managing some money? The police and fire and so forth. And didn't you? Odd actually walked in the St. Patrick's Day parade with the policeman's benefit fund, didn't you, Odd?
I used to be at the parade all the time.
Yeah.
Every year. Well, while you guys were yapping, I went over to grab my tax bill.
Yapping, you mean expounding on the truth of the world.
That too. So let's see. It's headlined with Where Your Money Goes. And then it breaks it down into how much more I'm paying, which is $332 more than last year, because we were reassessed.
Well, that's better than like $9,000, like some people, but still.
Yeah, it is. Let's see, school district. Yes, okay. So school district is a big chunk of it, obviously. But then I get the village, of course. Then Marine Valley College, the Water Reclamation District. We need water. Okay, I'll give you that. Library fund is a lot, but we have a fabulous library. County of Cook County Health and Hospital, County of Cook Public Safety. I'd love to know where my money's going with that. Forest Preserve District, yes, except for, okay, here's my bone to pick with Cook County Forest Preserve, so maybe somebody would call in and ask. Cook County Forest Preserves are my favorite thing about this area. As you know, I used to have my horse out here. People love the trails are incredible. It saves Chicago from being just another big city. But since, you know, things have changed here, I would love to know who has the sign commission that, you know, are posted and say what the forest preserve is. I would say the last signs were up there for 50 years, maybe, said, you know, you're at Swallow Cliff, you're at Dan Ryan Woods. Used to be little burgundy signs with white letters. Now, those signs change constantly all over Will Cook. I would love to know who's getting the sign franchise fee, because that's got to be huge money, the entire Cook County
system. It's the firm of Flanagan and Lawler.
You know, the change, I don't need to know half the things they put up there. You just need to know where you're at. So whatever Tony Preckwinkle needs to change all these signs, I'd love to know why. And who's if there's any competitive bid on the signs, I'd put my hat and ring on that.
Well, yeah, now, if you were doing it, it'd be good business, right? Good government.
No, it wouldn't. It still would be a waste of money. Then we have the town of Orland, your road and bridge for Orland. We have great roads, thank you. And then you have the South Cook County mosquito abatement costs, general assistance of Orland, and the consolidated elections. And it breaks it down from the starting high point of the school district, which is $4,300, the high school another $33,000, and the fire department, we definitely need them, so that's good. And then the very last thing is consolidated elections, which are $45,000. So you go from $4,300 to $45 in itemizations.
Really? Hey, yeah. I forgot to mention earlier, but the Bitcoin's down 6%, down $5,500.
Wow.
And $85,000. Ethereum is down 216 at 7%. What are we thinking, gang? Is there trouble in the Bitcoin world? What do we think happens if this keeps going?
I was following it a lot more closely the last week. I've been so busy, I've kind of not watched everything as close as I normally do. John, what do you think about that?
Well, go ahead, John.
Well, the volatility is, you know, it's different when you're not thinking of a commodity or precious metal or something in the usual sense of, you know, valuation changes. But this kind of you know, emphasizes the artificiality of all of this. I mean, here's something with no intrinsic value that's, you know, having, well, kind of frightening swings in value. It makes you think there's some kind of manipulation going on, or some kind of fear factor that's playing into this. And there's nothing else to fall back on except, you know, this is what people are starting to think about this. And I guess this is the risk you take when you have something like Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency that doesn't have intrinsic value.
When you say
value.
Something like Bitcoin, what in your lifetime has ever been like Bitcoin?
Well, nothing until this era of cryptocurrency, and where that you just make up, you know, here's a thing, and it's going to have, you know, negotiable value, and but you can't do anything with it. You can't melt it down. You can't put it in your teeth. You can't, build beautiful things with it. It's just, you know, something. It's like it could be, you know, horse dung too. But and maybe that's where we're headed. You know, maybe
we could. Well, there's been some effort. Some people have been able to use Bitcoin somewhat as a currency, but what do you do with Solana and Dogecoin? It's trading 13 cents. What if I have a million Dogecoins? What exactly do I do with them?
Go visit there.
Yeah, shove them where the sun don't shine, or what?
Go up to Holland. I don't know.
Melt them down to heat your house.
Yeah, except there's nothing to melt down. I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of stuff that we say on the show. I mean, there's some people here that are pretty smart in their areas that, even if we're all kidding around half the time, there's things that you sort of want to listen to that people have been, when you listen to Audrey about real estate, it's because she's been doing it forever. I mean, listen to Jan about, you know, his historical stuff in the city and city politics and stuff, because he's been a student of that forever. And he's a pretty darn good lawyer. But I'll tell you, the one thing you need to, if you're going to believe anything I say ever, is whenever you have borrowing on assets, where people are buying stuff and they borrowed money, if everybody just paid cash for everything, which of course is never going to happen, I'm not advocating that, because nobody can pay $400,000 for a house. Obviously, there's going to be leverage on something. But having said that, even with stocks, a lot of people, not at PTI, we don't really have people like this. Well, if we did, we'd make more money because you charge them a lot on the interest, but we don't have that. If a stock goes from 100 to 300, goes back to 100, I can absolutely guarantee you that more people lose money on the 200 down than on the 200, made money on the 200 up. And if you're not in the business, I mean, Aud obviously still has her Series 7 and 63 and stuff, she understands that. Aud, why don't you explain it differently? Because people borrow money along the way to buy the stuff. And when you come back down, there's buy the dippers, there's those kinds of things, there's leverage involved. Otherwise, it wouldn't make any difference, right, Aud?
Yeah, that's true. There's always a cost and a risk in everything. And, some of these people, they do leverage. You could leverage your house with a home equity loan. You're leveraging your stocks if you're borrowing or buying on margin. And you know, you could have your best laid plans, and all it takes is one blip in the world, and if they call your margin loan in or you can't make your home equity payment, you know, something's going to happen.
Well, Russell had the Bitcoin or all crypto, maybe... John, you were listening about 3-4 weeks ago. He had it at like $3.2 trillion value, right? Maybe 6 weeks ago. It was kind of at the tippy top when it was like $125,000 of Bitcoin. Well, now it's 85, so it's down a little more than, it's pushing 40%, right? I'm going to say that if you just did the math, it would mean that your value is now, you know, $2 trillion and not $3.2. I will just take a stab that all the owners of Bitcoin, you take all the stuff that's margined, all those kinds of things, somehow or another, people someplace are down more than $1 trillion. Do you guys understand? Well, you guys, I know you understand that because you've been in the stock world forever. John, do you understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And I can't put my finger on where that is. I mean, if it's all just a bunch of drug cartels, I guess I don't care. But there's got to be countries in this world. I have to think that a place like Venezuela, which has the currencies worth squat, some of these places are actually must be using this stuff, aren't they? And what happens to those people? Or does anybody care?
Well, it's also could be like, you know, it's still a new world, and I think there is going to be blips. It's here to stay because I think for two reasons. It is a portable, basically non-traceable currency, which makes it attractive to all types of people and industries. And, you know, that Bitcoin makes like a lot of stuff on the, if you want to look at things like the dark web or the cartels or arms trading or any place where you don't want your assets, so you could just put them on your little card and make sure you remember the code and hide it somewhere around the world. Something that it has value no matter what. Now, while they're trying, you've got part of the respectable part where it's traded on exchange and they're trying to make it a legit currency. And it is here to stay in some form, even though it's still a new thing and a lot of people say we all are suspicious of it, and with good right to be. But in many cases, it's just something that is here that is useful in the good and bad segments of society. So in spite of the blips, I think it's here.
Well, if you sold somebody a car and the guy paid for you in Bitcoin 3 weeks ago and you haven't done anything with your Bitcoin and now it's down 40% in 2 weeks, I'm not so sure I want that currency, do you, Jen?
Well, it's the same like gold. What if gold, you know, puked out tomorrow?
Well, at least you have some gold.
Or you have the fund or whatever. But again, if it goes from, you know, four back, say it went down back to two, you're still out two. Well, you have the asset, and you still have the Bitcoin.
Well, as you guys both know, I'm always worried about where exactly the you know, it's the same subject. We were talking about China earlier with John Lee. Who owes all this dough? Is it people here? Is it people that we don't know about? It always seems like whenever we have a crisis, it's because something pops up in an area we have no idea where it is. It seems to me that there's a lot of debt in China that some people here must have part of. I don't know if they're hiding it or they managed to cover it through other stuff. Somebody is getting nailed on this Bitcoin. Somebody is getting nailed on these downtown office buildings, right, Jen?
Yeah.
We seem like we're oblivious as to where the problem is, and yet it always manages to pop out someday, and we're going, man, how did that guy get all that debt on a Chinese, you know, condo complex or something? But it always happens, doesn't it?
Well, is there a price being paid by, you know, having an investment opportunity like, you know, cryptocurrency, siphoning money out of other investment markets that actually produce tangible things or, you know, food or whatever else? Has this had, you know, have we paid a price for having something like cryptocurrency and that money isn't being, you know, and you can see why people are doing it. I mean, it's an investment opportunity, and, you know, it has value and it can increase in value. But is that starving other, you know, places that need investment too?
Well, as a currency, I don't really have an issue with it. But to me, it's turned into an artificial stock, which is, dangerous.
Like,
me
too, yeah.
They want to make it a thing, like, you know, I mean, if you want to look at it on a bigger picture, it's, you know, we went from people who didn't trust the banks and kept their money under the bed, thinking the banks were okay, then they started investing in the stock market, then precious metals, now you're in Bitcoin. It's always the next best thing, and it takes a long time to assimilate something, especially on this big of a scale, into the economy for the average person. So how long will it be until you're just as happy, you know, whipping out your Bitcoin tokens to, you know, go shopping as you are whip out your Visa or MasterCard?
Well, the thing that I hope that we have a listener or two, because, Jen, when was it? It had to be 4 or 5 weeks ago where Carl said something about there was a glitch in one of the exchanges on this crypto stuff, and then all of a sudden the next day
that was a very big deal.
Yeah, but we've gone nothing but straight down from that day, roughly. Now, I don't know anything about how this thing works. I mean, I'm a total moron when it comes to this stuff, but I get the feeling that if all it's going to take is one glitch, some one hack someplace. And what else was it built on, Jen? The fact that it can't get hacked, right? Or people think it can't get hacked. What if somebody can get in there and steal your stuff? I'm not saying it's going to happen, but what if it does? I mean, what's
well,
left?
Probably
to fall
eventually
back?
You can. It's like they didn't think you could hack the internet either. So eventually, somebody figures something out.
Did you ever own any of this stuff, Hutch? I mean,
no.
You know, Dan's got $16 worth. My brother.
I'm Eastern European. We're slow to take on that stuff. We're suspicious.
You know that story, Jan, where he put $20 in the machine in the Fair Play on 111th Street, and they charged him $4 for the transaction. He ended up with $16.01 of Bitcoin.
Is that the old Jewel food store?
Yeah,
I know that place.
it has, shall we say, its own clientele. But of course he lost his password. Now you can't tell me that someday somewhere that his $16, whichever it is now, it's probably worth, you know, it's probably worth three or four times that. Somebody's not going to find his $48 and steal it. That you know, 3 centuries from now, there's still going to be $16 under some name, and they're waiting for him to like come out of the grave and claim it. You can't tell me that's going to happen.
They'll end up on the you know, Illinois Comptroller's list of lost property.
Who's going to send it there? Who's going to send it there? So what?
That's the whole thing. There's nobody knows you have it, so how are they going to come get you?
Well, it's anyway. So Aud, what's going on in the business? The economy's slowing just a hair, it seems, but doesn't seem to be bothering the real estate in your area, because that really never spiked in the first place. So it's kind of been steady all along, right?
It's been really steady. I mean, there was a blip when the interest rates were at its high, but it was interesting that last month when we had that tick downward into the low sixes, there was a huge spike in business, jumped up. Now, mortgage rates did tick back up a bit again, but if we get another break, it's good. It is busy. It still is, again, busy for the right property. But it's just... we get a half point to three quarters of a point break in interest rates, you're going to see a lot more business, a lot more homes coming on the market too.
When you say busy, compared to 6-7 years ago, you're busy because you have word of mouth and you're selling houses and listing houses for people that you did before. When you say busy, when I ask you and Nance, I always have to go one step further and say, okay, Nance, you're busy because you're good at this and been doing it a long time. How many less people are in your industry than there were 5 years ago? And I have to ask you the same thing. How many less real estate people are there less than 5 years ago?
Oh, I would say that, you're right. The tick upward in interest rate chased a lot of people out of the market. Therefore, it chased a lot of agents out of the market. Yes, if you're a new agent, new to the business, and you don't have reserves to help you as you're waiting out, learning the business, acquiring clients. I always tell new agents when they ask me that you have to treat real estate like any other business, where the effective rate to start a business is 3 to 5 years. So, you know, you've got to be able to float yourself for 6 months to a year. Plan on a minimum of 6 months, because it takes a lot of money to start up your own. You know, and you're testing your businesses, your licenses. Remember, they're not even going to buy you a pen, or you're buying your own computers, you're buying your own signs, and people don't plan for it. So people are used to getting that paycheck every 2 weeks, every month, and you don't get one unless you generate it. You do lose people because they still have bills to pay, and they'll try and work two jobs and stay in. But a lot of times people will come and go if they're just marginal. And it's not for everybody. It's a very time-consuming business that you could ask Tom how many dinners and family outings I've missed because of work, because that's just the nature of the beast.
Well, because you're working.
Audrey, are the big brokerage firms adding to staff? Are they hiring people right now?
I think they love to hire because there's no skin off their nose. If they have 50 people or 100 people, they're still most of them, you know, some of them collect rent. They take 50% of what
they
the
give them a desk or something. They don't give them a lot, you know, so they're not out a lot of money. Yeah,
you're paying for your own, and you know, when you start, a lot of times it's a 50-50 split between you and whoever sponsors you, whatever company, and you're still paying all the fees out of your end. So people think that real estate agents are all rich, and that's not true, because if there's a $10,000 commission and it's split, let's just say, for the sake of argument, maybe the other side gets half and the other company, two companies each get half, and then the agent has to split again with her company. They're not making 10 grand, they're making maybe 2,500, to use like just a round number to give people an idea. And now with the new negotiating the commissions, you know, then, you know, it's that's all over the table. So, but no, it's a lot of people don't stay, and I believe that the average broker only makes around 40 grand, 50 grand. It's not a lot, because it's a lot of hard work. So the small percentage that really succeed is, I would say maybe, like most businesses, maybe the top 10% make 80% of the money.
Well, what's the, when you list a nice place, which, you know, they're all pretty nice, but every, but Rod has done stuff in the entry level stuff in the threes, and what she did, you know, she's also had a couple that are a few over $1 million. Well, if you list a really nice shack for 900 grand, say, what's your cost out of the, just to put the thing in properly with the pictures and the drones and all the other stuff? I mean, how do you, or do you have to stage it? What is your cost going? It's got to be almost a G, isn't it?
Well, a lot of times it's over that, depending. I mean, you have to do beautiful professional pictures. You know, if you have a nice house, you don't want somebody whipping out their cell phone and, you know, taking a lousy picture. So you've got professional photography, may or may not have staging. I do my own, but a lot of people pay for that. And then if you want, you know, drones and nighttime pictures and brochures and extra internet advertising, it adds up very quickly. So, yeah, I mean, it's very easy to spend well over $1,000 to mark a home, easy. And then again, unless you sell the house, you don't make any money and you're out up front. So, you know, it's any type of sales business, as any salesperson will tell you, it's all about you know, you, how good you are. You'll know pretty well, pretty soon, if you're going to survive or not.
John, you have a quick question, because we got a dash.
Are you, how fast are deals closing now, Audrey? How long are places staying on the market before they get a nibble? And is financing moving along pretty fast, so there's no hitches? And is it, you know, can you expect to close in 60 days now?
You know what? I've got, I've had Dancy close things for me in anywhere from 2.5 weeks to 30 days. So if you have all your ducks in a row and you've got a good loan officer, you know, you could close things in 30 days. I would say things are moving along. There's not a big holdup in the financing. The market is doing okay. So I can't, you know, I think that's all fine. I think that is all a good situation right now. So the business is still there at homes. A good home is multiple offers. I will still tell you that in your, let's say, 250 to 500 range. If it's a nice house, you're still getting multiple offers. I have a young family that's looking for a home right now, and they're new to the market, and I'm trying to impress on them that if I tell you about the house on Tuesday, you don't have the luxury of waiting until Saturday to go look at it. You will have to go within 24 to 48 hours, or you're not going to get it. So it depends, again, location. But if it's nice, if it's hot, you're still going to have competition. There's still that pent-up demand right now.
Well, the places that close within a month, those are places that have already been to Nancy or somebody like Nancy and got a pre-approval and everything, right?
Well, everybody should have their pre-approval. I mean, at least you should actually, a pre-approval is that one, very quickly. You need a commitment letter, you need a full approval. If you want to compete in this market, a pre-approval is a very basic, superficial letter, and that does not mean you're going to get the money for sure until they pull your entire tax returns, your work history, your paychecks, your bank statements. You submit that and you get a full approval. That's what will speed your closing up. That's what your secret to succeeding in the house wars market right now. Get your full commitment commitment letter from your mortgage broker before you start house hunting.
Well, we got a dash, guys. It's still time for us to get in the snow plowing business this winter. It's early yet.
No, I'm just going to sit by the window and well, I did all my snow, and then you helped me out yesterday. So I have my own snow blower, and if it gets really bad, I just flag the guy down the street or my wonderful neighbors.
Yeah, if it wasn't for the neighbor yesterday, I'd have been skunked with all that stuff the guy plowed in.
Yeah, when they drop the snow at the foot of the driveway, the hunks of ice are 2 feet high. That's hard. But normally, I just fire up my little snowblower and get it going. Get you out on the outside.
How much money am I going to make if I have a snow plowing business and Jimmy and John are my drivers?
Well, you know what? Maybe we'll set you up in business. You guys could broadcast live from the truck.
Why are those two plows parked at that saloon? Oh, that's the chief's company.
It's a streets and sand.
It's a streets and sand.
We can do talk and walk.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Jimmy. Nice job. SP futures down 42, NASDAQ futures down 220. Gold up, silver up, Bitcoin way down. Back tomorrow, Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.